for members only. Golf Smarter number 358, published on November 20, 2012.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
More Score Zone Short Game Academy with Terry Kaler.
This is Golf Smarter. Each week, we tap the best minds in golf to help lower your scores with tips, drills, insights, and advice. In conversation with course pros, architects, authors, players, teaching gurus, and coaches, here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to Golf Smarter for members only, Terry.
Well, good evening.
It is a good evening indeed. So here's the deal. Usually Terry Kaler joins us for about 10 minutes on the regular Golf Smarter episodes. But I thought it would be fun, because we're getting so many questions in that we can't answer all the time, I thought it would be fun to spend an entire members-only episode with Terry answering more of these questions. So here's the deal. Usually on the Short Game Academy, Score Zone Short Game Academy, if we use your question, you're eligible to win a free scoring club from Score Golf. But because this is outside of the normal range, our normal realm here, here's the way we're going to play this one out. You are still eligible. If we use your question in this episode, you are eligible to get a free scoring club from Score Golf. But there are two caveats to that. One, if we use your question, you have to email me and say, Fred, I heard my question. So the way to do it is click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com and say, I heard my question on the members only episode. The other element that we have to throw in a curveball here is you're going to have to pay for the shipping, but that's all you're going to have to pay for. You're going to get one of these amazing clubs. You'll get one, you'll pay for the shipping, and then you're going to want to use your Golf Smarter for members only discount. You're 15% with the coupon code GolfSmarter15 to get discount and buy the whole set, because it's just going to change your game and you're going to enjoy yourself so much more. Terry, is that fair? Is that an okay way to do it?
That works for me.
All right, well, then it works. Okay, so we've got four really interesting questions that I'd like to cover today. See if we can do this. And we have as much time as we want to do it. So I'm going to go start right here. Let's do this one. Matthew Etter of Durham, North Carolina, writes in and says, what is the recommended approach for handling flyer lies around the green? Great question. In my area, we have a lot of Bermuda grasses. And when cut high, there can be a lot of space between the ball and the ground. Should you still try to hit down on the ball to impart spin? It seems to me, at least, to Matthew, that there's no way you're going to compress the ball when it's sitting up so much. But trying to scoop the ball with the ascending blow doesn't seem like the right approach either. So what are the alternatives? What are your suggestions?
Well, we play the Bermuda rough down here in Texas, too. So I'm very familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, a flyer lie, there's nothing you can do about that. The ball is going to fly out of that lie. It's sitting up in the Bermuda. You're going to get grass between the club face and the ball, which is going to fill the grooves on the club with grass, which is going to make the club, it's kind of like your car hydroplaning. That ball is going to hydroplane, so to speak, off the face of that golf club, because the grooves are going to fill with grass.
Could you, I'm sorry for interrupting, but can you explain flyer lie? Because, you know, some of this inside baseball stuff, not everybody knows every term.
Okay, so a flyer lie is when the ball is sitting kind of halfway up in the stems or blades of the grass. And the bottom of the ball is not really on the ground. The bottom of the ball is above the ground. And there's grass around the ball, so it's nestled in this grass. What happens with the flyer lie, what we call a flyer lie, is you cannot make crisp impact on the golf ball because this grass around it. So when you hit that, when you make impact at that fraction of a second, this grass between the ball and the club face is going to compress into the grooves of the club face. So it creates an effect similar to when your car hydroplanes on the highway. There is a loss of friction there because this grass is between the club face and the golf ball, and the grooves, i.e. the tread of the tires, is now filled with material. So there is not a coefficient of friction happening. So the ball rockets off of the club face with a minimum of spin, and you see one of two things happen. Either the ball, which is kind of a quasi-knuckleball, it either just flies forever, or in a windy condition, you'll quite often see the ball jump up in the air and then just look like it's being thrown back to the ground because it doesn't have underspin, backspin to keep it airborne. So you'll see one of those two impacts. In other words, the effect of this is you don't know how far that ball is going to go. You don't know how it's going to stay airborne. There are some, and a flyer lies is the penalty of being in the rough. This is what the whole USGA groove rule was about, is to penalize you for hitting it in the rough. And with the old hard edge square grooves, you could cut through that material and still impart backspin to the ball from a flyer lie. And what the USGA watched, I'm kind of diverting here, but kind of what happened is the USGA saw that there was a deteriorating relationship between hitting the ball in the fairway and scoring. Because guys could hit these square groove wedges as good out of the rough as they could out of the fairway. And that took away the premium of hitting the ball in the fairway. So back to your flyer lie, what happens is you're going to get material between the club face and the ball. You cannot pinch the ball into the turf. You can't trap the ball or however you want to express that, because the ball isn't sitting down on the turf. It's suspended up in the stems and leaves of the grass. What you have to allow for is that there's, no matter how skilled you are, this ball is going to jump on you a little bit. This ball is not going to have the spin that you would normally affect to have. So if you've got this flyer lie and a close cut pin, if there is trouble right behind the pin, your best shot may be to play right or left of that flag. Your best shot may be to allow for that ball to hit short of the green and run on. One of my favorite approaches to a flyer lie is to take a lower lofted golf club, a 9-iron, even a pitching wedge, where you have less loft, so not as much of the club is going to go under the ball, and play that ball to kind of jump out of there with the minimum of spin and bump and run it into the green. Even if it's an 80 or 90 or 120-yard shot, play that ball with the lower lofted club, a softer swing, and play that ball to release into the green. If that green is protected by water or a big bunker, this is a hole maybe you need to consider, hey, I'm not going to get this shot to stop. And if there's trouble behind the green and trouble short, maybe this is a hole that I lay it up short of the trouble into the fairway where I can then nip a wedge in, make sure I don't make worse than bogey on this hole. Though not every hole is a par hole, not every hole is a birdie hole. Some holes aren't even a bogey hole. This is where reading your lie and knowing what you can expect to be able to do out of that lie determine the way you play the rest of that hole. Sometimes you have to take your medicine in this game and go, you know, I hit it over here in trouble. I'm going to have to play this hole for no worse than a bogey and still give myself a chance at par, instead of saying, I think I can pull this shot off. I've never done it before in my life, but I think I can pull it off this time. And then you end up with a 6 or a 7 or an 8.
Practice. Don't try it for the first time when you're on the course. Practice.
Well, you know, it's like that Holiday Inn commercial, and the guy says, are you a surgeon? He goes, no, but I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night. I think they're down here in the South, there's a saying about the famous last words of a redneck, and that's, hold my beer and watch this.
Okay, I don't even want to know what happens afterwards. All right, well, that was good. That was really interesting and made me think about on the last score short game academy that we did, and you were talking about keeping your hands in front of, on the short ones, keeping your hands, making sure that you keep your hands out in front of the club. And I actually went out and played today. I had so much fun. It's been so long since I've had a chance to play. A great 5-mile walk. Just loved it. Anyway, so I went out in the practice green before the round, and I was working on that shot. I was so excited because I remembered what you said. I was working on it, get my hands out in front, not gripping too tight, and it all worked until I got on the golf course, and then I just whee right across the top of the green.
Trip from the driving range to the golf course, that's the longest trip in golf.
Well, let's work our way from the green backwards. Here's the next question. This one comes from Matt McElroy. He lives in Brentwood, New Hampshire, and is a longtime Golf Smarter listener. So I'm happy to ask your question, Matt. And again, if we use it, you hear it, send me an email saying you heard us use it, and we'll put you in touch with the folks at Score Golf. So you can get your club, and you just have to pay for the shipping. So he wants to know, how do we know which scoring club? See that he even put scoring club. This is how well he listens. That's pretty good. How do we know?
Yo, Matt.
How do we know which scoring club to use from the sand? Are different types of sand a factor?
Well, you have two things. When you're in a bunker, Matt, there's two things you need to consider. And the first thing is the texture of the sand. And the second thing is how far do you want this ball to fly and how do you want it to roll out? So, you know, it's the same thing, the decision you make in the fairway, whether you're going to chip the ball to release and run or whether you're going to try to throw it all the way back to the flag with your lob wedge. Let's take the bunker texture first. The softer the texture of the sand, the higher bounce club you want to use. So if you're carrying three or four scoring clubs, and in our world, we have this patented V-sole that combines a high and a low bounce into each club, but you still have some variances on how much bounce it has. So know your golf clubs, Matt. First thing, know your golf clubs. And if you're in a very soft, fluffy bunker, take a club that you can put more bounce into, that you can lay the club open. It increases the bounce and helps the club reject out of that sand. If you're in a firm bunker, maybe it rained last night or the sprinklers were running, and or just that particular golf course has tighter, firmer sand, then go with your lower bounce golf club. There's really nothing wrong with hitting bunker shots with gap wedges, even with your pitching wedge, your 9-iron. These clubs have low bounce, and you can lay the club open still and get a little more bounce out of it. But if you have a long 70, 80, 90-foot bunker shot, don't grab your lob wedge and walk in there and try to make a big old hard swing to fly it all the way back to that hole. If you've got a lot of green to work with, which typically you would on a long bunker shot, go ahead and take that 9-iron or pitching wedge and lay the club open and make a softer swing where if you catch it a little thin, you're not quite so penalized. If you catch it a little heavy, you're not quite so penalized. I'm a big believer that we're all trying to play this game for a number, and look at your risk reward on any shot. And I was just joking about the hold my beer and watch this, but a lot of golfers play the game that way. You know, I don't know if I can pull this off, but I saw it in a cartoon once, or I saw it on tour once. But you know, play within your skill set. So firm sand, go to your lower lofted club. Longer shots, go to your lower lofted club. And give yourself the maximum margin of error. And the way to gauge the sand, when you walk into the bunker, feel it in your feet. You know, when you set into a shot, if you feel like this is pretty crusty, tight sand, and you step in there and wiggle your feet a little bit and find that, hey, there's a little crust, but it's real soft underneath, don't be afraid to go back out and get a different golf club. You know, get a club with a little higher bounce. Soft, fluffy bunkers are the hardest bunkers to play. That's why you never see them on the PGA Tour. If you look at a PGA Tour, those guys never get fried eggs. They never get buried lies. They play firm, wet bunkers because you can spin the ball. You can make the ball do a lot of stuff out of that. Most of us play much harder bunkers than the PGA Tour players play. So don't expect to hit bunker shots like they do.
Are you kidding me?
No, absolutely. The PGA Tour has a standard for sand texture, and that's why when we see on the PGA Tour, the ball always flies into the bunker, it splashes and then releases over, and they're firm, wet sand, and that's the easiest bunker shot there is firm, wet sand. You can spin the ball, you can make it do all kinds of things out of that, because that's about the TV audience. They want to see these guys, you know, knock the flags down.
Well, I remember I've heard numerous times where the announcer's saying, well, he's going to try to hit the bunker on this one so it doesn't go hit the green and bounce over.
Right.
Like from a far distance that they prefer to hit in the bunker.
And, well, they know exactly what they're going to get. We just talked about the flyer lie.
Right.
You don't get flyer lies out of a bunker.
Right.
And these tour players, I mean, and granted, these guys have phenomenal skills. They spend hours and hours and hours in bunkers. But think of how good your bunker play would be if every bunker you ever went into from now on was exactly the same. That's what they get.
Yeah.
But they are the best player in the world.
Yeah, well, of course. Can you, and hey, here's blatant plug for your product line, but can you explain more about VSOL technology? Because I was showing off the clubs today, as I do every time I'm on the golf course, going, oh, you got to check these out.
And we appreciate that.
Absolutely. And I can get you a discount. And so someone's like, well, what's the bounce on this? And I was like, VSOL patented, I'm really, what? So can you help us with that? Explain that again.
Well, in conventional wedges, before we created the VSOL, you have high bounce and low bounce wedges. And the big manufacturers talk about high bounce is good for fluffy lies and soft bunkers, and low bounce is good for tight lies and firm bunkers. Well, what we just talked about is, you know, there's not a listener out here has a clue what the next bunker lie is going to look like.
Absolutely.
And or what the next fairway or rough lie. So I don't know what I'm going to have for my next wedge shot, but I do know that the wedge I have in my bag better be able to handle it. And so we created this thing called the VSOL. And what it does is it takes a low bounce in the main part of the sole and complements that with a very high bounce in the first quarter inch of the sole. So we essentially combine a high bounce and a low bounce into each club so that you never find a lie your club doesn't like. One of our customers many years ago put it better than I could ever put it, which kind of made me mad because I'm a copywriter. But he said, it lets me dial in exactly the bounce I need for whatever lie my ball finds. Mm. And that's really what you need to do. You need to be able to dial in the bounce. Our club, like any other club, if you lay it open, you increase the bounce. If you square it up, you decrease the bounce. Mm-hmm. But within that framework, we give you a wider range. So you can take your 57 or 59 or 55 degree score and you can make it a low bounce wedge. You can make it a high bounce wedge. You can make it do what you want it to do. And one of the other comments I always loved from a customer was he said, my wedge just knows what it needs to be. So
I bet you like that comment.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the feedback we get. It's a different sole. It's patented. It's different than anything you'll find in the store on anybody else's wedge. I encourage all of your readers to try it. If you don't like it, send it back to us. That's always our guarantee.
And I like
I'm sorry,
that guarantee.
Sorry, that went into a shameless plug.
No. You're allowed
to play better golf.
No, you're allowed to make shameless plugs, and the guarantee is a huge one. Give me another 5 seconds on that.
Well, I mean, our whole thing is we sell a lot of clubs online. We're a young company. We don't have a lot of distribution. You can find them in most of the Edwin Watts stores now, but your club probably doesn't have it yet. We haven't gotten out there. So if you go online, read about our golf club and decide you like, you know, hey, this looks pretty interesting to me, then buy one, go play it, buy a full set, go play them. Because what we've taken is a full set approach to the short game. We're not about sand wedges and lob wedges and gap wedges. We're about a systemized approach to the short end of your set. And we want you to be better inside 9-iron range. And we have built a set of golf clubs. That's all we do is 9-iron on in. We've been doing, and this is kind of an aside, but we've been doing a very deep dive into PGA Tour statistics. And what we really are finding is the difference between the haves and the have-nots on the PGA Tour is not their long-range performance, it's their short-range performance. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting study that we'll be publishing probably later this year, early next.
Well, I think that it's a really good lead-in to our next question, and this one comes from Ron Hampel, who's in Portland, Oregon. And let me say, before I read the question, Ron, listen, I've been playing golf now for about 15 years, and I still consider myself a new golfer. I learn stuff from these interviews that I'm like, that are epiphanies for me, that I'm like, York, I never knew that. So when you say I'm fairly new to golf, having taken the game up 18 months ago, you're an infant. You know, there's just so much to learn. It's true. There's so much to learn. And some of the stuff that you hear, but it takes years before you even get it. And that's the thing that I find so fascinating about this game is that I'm like, you know, I've heard it over and over, and then I'm finally like, oh, that's what they meant, you know, that kind of stuff. So anyway, this is Ron's question. He said, my play from tee to about 120 yards or so is really coming along, about 70 to 75% driving accuracy. That's pretty impressive.
That's better than anybody on tour.
Yeah, so you know what? I hate to break this to you, Ron, but if you make it, if your ball is not on the fairway and it's in the first cut, then you're not really... Your driving
Ron,
accuracy.
Quit practicing your driver. You're as good as you're going to get. Start working on the short,
short game, right? So he says, "Here's what's holding back my scoring back is what happens from inside 120 yards. My short game distance control is all over the place. Why will adding a wedge or two to my set at that end of my set make my distances any more accurate? In other words," he says, "is my lack of consistency due to the skills of being a new golfer or incorrect club gaps?"
Yes.
Thank you. Next question.
So, Ron, we're here to offer absolution tonight. It's not your fault. What happens is that the scoring range performance inside 9-iron range, inside 8-iron range, I've created this little thing. I call it the scoring triangle. And on one side of the triangle is technique. And you have to learn a good technique for hitting short range shots. The cool thing about that is that if you learn a good technique for hitting short range shots, that same technique will help you hit mid range shots and long range shots. But the one side of the triangle is technique. Second side of the triangle is time. This is the bulk of your shots on the golf course. If you take your drives and your putts out, you're going to hit seven. If you're playing the right tees for your skill level and your distance, you're going to hit 70 to 75% of your shots inside 9-iron range. Do you give that 75% of your practice time? If not, that's one part of your problem. The third side of the triangle, so you have technique, you have time. The third side of the triangle is tools, and you have to have the right tools. And what we have in our bags today, you guys have in your bags today, because I've got score 41-61s in my bag. So does Fred.
Yes, I do.
And about 10,000 other people.
Congratulations.
Thank you. But what you have in your bag, and I can prove this to you photographically, I can prove this to you technically, you have these things that you've called wedges that have not changed in the weighting distribution and the basic design 60 years. I have in my collection a 1950 vintage Spalding tournament model that if I re-chromed it and put slick graphics on it, you would swear it's the coolest new thing in wedge. It's got some really neat nuanced grinds on it. But the essence of a wedge is that it has all the weight on the bottom of the sole and a very thin upper three-fourths of the face. And that produces great disparity of ball performance off of the face of that golf club. So your distance control issues very well might be 60% technique, 70% technique, but they may only be 30% technique, because your new brand A, brand B, brand C, and I'm not going to slam anybody, looks just like your old brand A, brand B, brand C, because they look like this 1950 Spalding tournament model. Now, in 1949, Ben Hogan, in his book, said the maximum distance of a sand wedge is 40 yards. I was with a group of golfers last night that ranged from 7 to 18 handicap, and the average person there said they hit their sand wedge routinely 80 and 85 yards. I said, really? Well, then you must be twice as good as Ben Hogan, because he hit his over 40. So the tool is not designed. What we have in our bag that we call wedges are very short-range golf clubs, 20 to 25-yard golf clubs. But we use them in a full swing environment today. So the fact that you have distance control issues may not really be your fault. It may be the tools. I suspect, because you're a new golfer, there's also some technique and probably some time issues there. But the third element of that is the tools. And if you don't have the right tools in your bag, you're not going to have good distance control. And what we see happening in golf is the companies are strengthening the lofts of our irons. A P club, as I call it, has gone from when I was in my 20s, 49 or 50 degrees, to in my 30s, 47 or 48 degrees. Now I'm 60 and I see companies making P clubs of 43 and 44 degrees. We're compressing the set by strengthening these short clubs, but we're not giving you better tools to fill in those gaps. So, and I'll go back to this tool question. I had a guy told me the other day he got a new set of XYZ irons, and he said they're unbelievable. He said, I used to not be able to hit a pitching wedge but 115, and I'm hitting my pitching wedge 125 now. And I said, really? Well, what do you hit when you're 115 yards from the hole then? Because you still need that shot.
Yeah, you really do.
And they took that away from you. But what they did is they didn't give you an extra 10 yards with your four iron, but they did give you an extra 10 yards with your P club, so they compressed your set. The other thing I look at is I look at the guys on the PGA Tour and carrying four or five clubs that go over 200 yards, some of them six, not counting the driver. Well, outside of 200 yards, the difference between average distance to the hole for the best guy on tour and the worst guy on tour is 9 feet. Hmm. The best guy on tour averages 42 feet proximity to the hole from outside 200 yards. The number 125 guy is 50 feet. Well, you know, you don't make a lot more 42-footers than 50-footers. So they're really kind of equal out there. So the whole tour is essentially equal outside 200 yards. But if you go to the 100 to 125 range, the best guy is 13 feet and the number 125 guy is 21 feet. Well, you're going to make a lot more 13-footers than 21-footers.
Especially on the tour.
Yeah, I mean, especially on, but any of us, we're going to make more putts from 13 feet than 21 feet. So doesn't it make sense that guy's not going to get any better with a 5-iron from 215 or 220, but he could spend a lot more time and get better equipment inside 125, and he could start closing that gap to that 13-foot guy, and he's going to move up the money list pretty quick. What would one more birdie a week be worth to an average tour player? I did this calculation many years ago, that one more birdie a week would be worth something like $190,000 a year. That was when the leading money winner was making $1 million.
Wow.
Now that the leading money winner is making $8 million, I mean, I need to get my college student that does market research for us. I need to get her to go in and find out what would happen if you took the number 120 guy on the money list and gave him one more birdie a week for his 25 or 28 tournaments. What would that have done for him? One stroke a week.
Well, actually, I'm booking right now a PGA Tour player, and I'm going to ask him that.
Ask him that. What would you have done last year if you'd have made one more birdie a week? And do you think you're going to do that with your 4, 5, and 6 iron? Are you more likely to do that with your 9 and your wedges?
I'm writing that down. I'm going to ask that question.
It's all about the tools in your bag. The average guy on tour today carries 3 clubs, maybe 4, that he plays the golf course inside of 150 with. Ben Hogan had 7 clubs in his bag to play the inside 150 shots. Well, if you're going to try to be as good as he was inside 150 and he has 7 tools and you have 1, or I mean you have 3, you're not going to be as good as that guy. Just can't. You can't practice enough. It's kind of like if you go to your auto mechanic and he and you look at his toolbox and he's got a crescent wrench, a Phillips screwdriver, and a pair of vice grips, he's probably not going to be that good at fixing your car.
He's probably not going to charge you top dollar either.
Yeah, but he's not going to do a very good job because the other guy's got, you know, 3 toolboxes full of Snap-on tools and he's got every tool possible. So it's about having the right tools in your bag. Your distance control, what I would do is go out. And go back to this question. We're kind of rambling here. I'm sorry. But if you go out and take your short game clubs, your high loft golf clubs, and get your laser rangefinder or step it off if you have to, and go find out how far you hit each of these.
Hmm. Yeah. So Matt Every is on the tour now, and he's going to be on the show. I'm going to be interviewing him in the next week. So if you're hearing this episode the week it's published, then I've coming up next probably is going to be this guy, Matt Every. And I'm real curious, if you have questions that you'd like to ask this new young PGA Tour player, I've already got a couple here from Terry. Send them in to me. I'm curious. Terry, do you have any questions? If you got a chance to ask a PGA Tour player, a young, upcoming, young stud who was highly decorated in his college career, I'm curious about his distances as well. So
I would ask him, do you know your statistics, Matt, of how many shots you hit from outside 200 yards and how many clubs you have to do it versus how many shots you hit from inside 150 and how many clubs you have to do it? And is your set makeup really matched to the way you play the game today?
I'm taking notes.
Good.
Yeah. No, that's great. Thank you. I'm curious, when you asked that guy you were playing with and you said that he seemed so excited about getting these new clubs that he was getting 10 more yards on his 9-iron, and you said, yeah, what do you do for that 115 now that you don't have any more? What was the look on his face when you asked him that?
It was incredulous. It was like a deer in the headlights.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
What do you mean? What do you mean? Isn't it good that I hit everything further? Because, you know, every ad I read says if I hit it further, I'm going to be better. And I will offer your readers and or your listeners, I would like to offer everybody a challenge. And I invite you all to go do this and then send Fred your email. Go play 18 holes of golf some afternoon, just a recreational round. And every hole, take your drive and walk it 15 yards further on the line it was going on. Not further down toward the hole, but if it's going right, walk it right. If it's going left, walk it left. If it's in the middle of the fairway, walk it down the middle of the fairway. And add 15 yards to every drive. Just walk it 15 steps, put it down, and play the hole out. And tell us what you shoot. And I will guarantee you that 15 more yards will not lower your handicap a stroke.
That's an awesome challenge.
Now, I challenge all of you. But then I'm going to offer you the other challenge. And go write your score down, and every time you're inside 9-iron range, no more than 3 strokes. If you're inside 9-iron range, you average 3 strokes, regardless whether you're a 16 or a 6 handicap. And just add that up, going, okay, I played 18 holes, and every time I got inside 9-iron range, I gave, whether it took me 3 or 4 shots to get there, but when I got inside 9-iron range, I added 3 to that, and that was my score on the hole. But then I played it out and see how many strokes you beat your real score by if you were really decent inside 9-iron range.
Hmm. Yeah, turning 3 shots into 2, right?
No, turning 3 shots into 3 instead of turning 3 shots into 5. That's what the average golfer does.
Yeah, you're right.
He gets down there, he's 135 yards, got a 9-iron in his hand, and he hits it long, short, you know, and then he makes a bad chip. Next thing you know, he's put a 5 or 6 on the card. It's like, I was a, and then you know what happens? You walk off the hole and your buddies go, hey, nice drive, Fred.
and that actually happened to me today. I had with my 3-wood, I had a great drive right up the center, and it went a very good distance. And now I am 9-iron in, and I just collapsed and 4-putted. It was awful. It was really so bad.
Because what happens when you hit a bad shot, now you're pressing your putt and, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, all that kind of thing.
And it also reminds me of one of the shows that you and I did a while back. And that was, and it's a challenge that I talk about on the course a lot. And is, I'd rather have 10 feet closer than 10 yards farther any day of the week.
Oh, it'll change your scores dramatically. 10 yards longer does not make that big a difference in your scoring.
Interesting.
I mean, all of us are way longer than we were, say, 20 years ago.
Sure.
But U.S. handicaps haven't changed.
Yeah.
Playing it shorter than – we're playing it into the green with a shorter club than we ever have, and handicaps haven't changed.
And the obsession with distance, even on golf course design, it's just out of control.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, what's interesting, and I was talking about tour statistics a while ago, from 175 to 200-yard approaches, the number one guy on tour and the number 125 guy on tour are 5 feet, 4 inches apart.
Mm.
Okay? But if I go to 100 to 125 yards, the number one guy to the number 25 guy are 5 feet, 4 inches apart.
Interesting.
So if you look and then you go to 75 to 100 yards, the number one guy to the number 125 guy is 6 feet apart. So there is more separation the closer you get to the green from the best and the worst on tour. So I'm not going to pick on anybody, but Jim Furyk is number 120 on tour from 75 to 100 yards. He averages 18 feet from the hole.
Hmm.
Number one guy on tour is Bo Van Pelt at 12 feet one. He's a third closer to the hole on average inside 100 yards. Well, who's going to make more birdies, the guy that putts from 12 feet on average or the guy that putts from 18 feet on average? You know, and so if you go back and you go to this 175 to 200 range, Robert Garrigus is number one on tour at 29.5 feet. Kyle Reifers is number 125 at 34.10. Well, you know, you're not going to make a lot more 29-footers than 34-footers, but you are going to make a lot more 12-footers than 19-footers, a lot more. So where are you going to cut the strokes on your score? You're going to cut them with your high loft clubs. You're going to cut them with your 9-iron to wedges. And if your guys would all give 80% of your practice time to your high loft golf clubs for a month, your handicap will come down. Guaranteed. Has to.
Fascinating. All right, last question for this one. And again, thanks for taking so many of these questions and for offering the clubs to these people. And if I've used your question, make sure you send me an email saying you heard it. And then you will get a chance to get a customized score 4161, but you have to pay for the shipping. And this could be an interesting one because Martin Baker is from Paragian Beach. I don't even know how to pronounce it, but it's in Queensland, Australia. Sorry, Marty. So actually interesting, Martin Baker, and we'll call him Marty, he uses the old Eidolon wedges, and he's been listening to the podcast for a long time, and he was really intrigued about you talking a while ago about the grip, and he sent you a photo of his glove. Now, he said, from the photo, you may be able to work out whether I'm holding the club too much in my hand instead of my fingers, as you have talked about. He was also intrigued by your comments about keeping the grip light on the club. I think this would naturally relax the forearms and therefore give a more relaxed looking swing like the professionals. Is that true? So
yes.
You've seen the picture of his glove. Uh-huh. And describe it for us, please, and then your insights.
The picture he sent in had a wear spot right on the heel of the hand. And that's the most common wear spot you see on golf gloves. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One reason is because
I just want to confirm, the heel is the base of the hand opposite your thumb.
Right.
Okay.
The heel pad. Yeah. Right. Up at the heel pad.
Got it. Okay.
And the reason golfers wear their gloves out there is there's a couple of reasons. One is, as he mentioned, you need to have the club in your left hand really in your fingers, and you roll your fingers up so that the club is below that heel pad. That's first thing. Second thing is the butt end of the golf club has to be outside that heel pad. And when you think of gripping down on a club, you know, what we want to do is we want to grip just enough to where that the grip cap is not up in our glove. We have to get our think about it. You've got your smallest finger on your hand gripping the biggest part of the grip. You would be amazed, and I invite all of you to do it, to watch what happens to your distances and your ball flight if you will go out and just hit shots with every one of your golf clubs and grip them down a full inch to where you get down into a narrower part of that grip. But the other reason is, and I think it was the last week or week before the last show or the show before that, we talked about the proper release of the club.
Yeah,
and the
one.
Club can your hands cannot hinge. They have to rotate to release the golf club. And you want to grip the club with the upper three fingers of your left hand so the club is cannot move around in your hand. It cannot slide. And what causes that wear spot on the heel of your glove is because that club is sliding up and down across that heel pad, and the grip has got a frictionless surface, and so it's wearing away at that leather. But a really good player doesn't let that happen. A really good player has a firm grip on the club with the last three fingers of their left hand, and they're not hinging through impact. They're rotating through impact so that club stays down in those fingers. And if it's not moving, it can't wear your glove out. The only way a grip can wear your glove out is if it's moving in your hand. And if you're re-gripping the golf club or if the club is sliding around, obviously you're losing a lot of control of that golf club. So move the club further down in the fingers than you ever thought possible, and maintain a firm grip on it with your last three fingers of your left hand, not your pincher fingers and your thumb. But those last three fingers of your left hand, that's where you want to control the golf club. You want to feel throughout the golf swing that you have total control of the golf club with those last three fingers of your left hand.
And you are talking about right-handed golfers.
Right. Excuse me. Yeah. For the lead hand. Let's put the upper hand. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. Well, that was phenomenal. And I really appreciate you giving us the time to be able to answer a bunch of questions at once. But on our next episode of Golf Smarter, you will come back and it will be a full Score Zone Short Game Academy, where we will answer one more question. And we encourage everyone, send in your questions, please. Terry is just, he's so knowledgeable. It's so much fun to get to ask these questions because I don't always see the things that you see. And I love your feedback. I love your input. So please go to golfsmarter.com and click on Score Zone Short Game Academy and ask questions, and I'll forward them off to Terry, and he and his staff weed through them and pick out the ones that they want to talk about on the show. So, Terry, thanks so much again, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, sounds great, Fred. Look forward to the next one.
Hey, it's getting to be a habit, but I don't have a problem with it. Another hole-in-one from a Golf Smarter member. Congratulations, Michael Hamill. And now we officially hate you. When I said that last time about officially hating Don Eskin, I got an email from his wife saying, oh, great, it's wonderful to be married to a guy that officially is hated by everybody. What can I do? Hey, if you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, of course, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.